Hey, I'm Celia, here with another Young Scientist Spotlight for Carry the One Radio, where we hear about the people behind the next wild things to shake up the scientific universe. I had the pleasure of talking with Dr. Nancy Padilla. She's a neuroscientist who studies social dominance in mice. Basically, how they figure out who's the boss. She also told me about some amazing undergrad mentorship in Puerto Rico, the awesome lab she's going to run someday, and how mice might be able to use their recording devices to beat each other up. It's adorable, she's a delight, and I'm so excited for you to meet her. Enjoy!
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
The University of California.
San Francisco.
My name is Nancy Padilla, and I'm a neuroscientist. I'm a postdoc at the Salk Institute. I'm in general interested in understanding how the brain controls social behaviors. And the particular project that I have as a postdoc right now is to understand how the brain controls specifically social dominance behaviors. For that, we use mice as a model.
What exactly is social dominance? Like, how do you define that in mice?
Mice, similarly to many other social species, live in groups, and they organize the behavior of the group with social dominance hierarchies. And by that, we mean that there's some animals that have priority access to resources. In mice, particularly, there's linear hierarchies. You know, there's going to be an alpha mouse that's going to have priority number one, and then there's going to be one that's rank number two, rank number three, and so on. There are behavioral assays to figure out the linear hierarchy, so we use that.
Is that different from how humans organize themselves, or like how even other primates would organize themselves socially?
So I think that for humans, social hierarchies are much more flexible, so they're context dependent. Right? Like at work, we have a specific hierarchy, and maybe at home, we have a different hierarchy.
And in mice, it's not that way?
I think if we were able to study mice in the wild, we would be able to figure out better if it's context dependent. In some of my own experiments, this is more observational data. We've done experiments in which we switch the cages, and they're able to, you know, an animal that was previously an alpha maybe becomes an intermediate or could become a subordinate. And if we return them back with their original partners, they can come back to be the alpha. So in that way, it's possible that they also have that flexibility of, depending on their social context, they might be higher ranking or lower ranking, depending who's around.
Can you describe a little more then, like, how do you have these mice set up? Like, what's their living arrangement look like when you're doing these kinds of experiments?
It's expensive to keep mice in individual cages, and also they don't like it. They, you know, social isolation sucks, as we're experiencing right now with the pandemic. So normally, mice are kept in multiple animals per cage. In my case, we keep them in groups of four. So that means that, you know, they have these three other buddies that they essentially live with in the lab, and they fight until they establish a hierarchy. But in my experiments, rather than studying what happens in the home cage, because, you know, depending on the type of mice, you kind of have to like give them a situation to show their dominance. Otherwise, they're just chilling and grooming each other, eating, sleeping, not much to it, right? There's not much to it in a home cage. So I force them into a situation of competition. I teach them to associate a tone with a reward. And then once they learn that individually, I have them compete for the reward with a home cage that they already have established a social rank with. So that way there's a trial structure and there's some repetition, and I can look at their behavior across trials, essentially creating an environment in which their rank matters.
What does it take for a mouse to emerge as victorious in these competitions?
They're a little bit physical, but they never really fight for it. You know, I think that based on their social history with each other, they're like, oh, well, I'm here with mouse X. Okay, I should let mouse X go for it more often. So, like, you know, there's one little port, there's a tone, and then there's one little drop of reward that comes with every tone. And technically, you could push your way into getting the reward, right? Like, you can, like, dominate the space physically. But sometimes you have animals that win the reward with very little effort because the other animal is subordinate to them. So then they're like on the corner and they're like, oh, it's okay. You'll get it. That's fine. They're not necessarily confrontational about it.
That's so cute. What got you interested in this line of work anyway? Like, was this what you were doing as a grad student before you started working in this lab?
Not at all. From the very beginning of my career as a neuroscientist, I was interested in behavior. If we go back even more, what got me interested in the brain was music. When I was in middle school and high school, I was pretty seriously trained as a musician because I was in this music school. I was really into it and I was like, oh, maybe I'll study music because it was like a school specialized for music. But what I really wanted to understand was how music changes our behavior and our emotional state. I went into undergrad not really knowing how I was going to study the brain, but I was like, I want to understand how the brain has so much power over our behavior and how like the stimuli that we interact with, like music, right, can change how we feel and how we act. And eventually I realized that there was something called neuroscientists and like that you could study the brain. And then I quickly like was like, oh, wow, I'm going to study neuroscience. And I found a lab when I was in an undergrad that studied fear learning. So then that was a very basic behavior. And that seemed like a really great model because you could do it in rodents and it's an emotion, right? So that was my start. I was studying brain regions that are involved in learning fear and then in extinguishing that fear. And then for grad school, I wanted to keep in that line of research, but I became more curious in understanding innate behaviors rather than learned behavior. So then I was studying avoidance behavior. And then towards the end of grad school, I was no longer satisfied with that level of behavior. But I'm like, these behaviors are not complex enough. I want to understand more complex behaviors. And then I also realized that our understanding of the social brain is really primitive. Part of that is because it's really difficult to study social behaviors. Like instead of having one subject, you have two subjects, like, and it's more than double the trouble. So it makes sense that we're behind when it comes to understanding how the brain controls social behavior. So for me, that felt like an opportunity. Like this is a good place to be in neuroscience because we're behind. So there's more opportunity to make a difference.
Besides the fact that there's literally just more mice that you have to deal with per experiment, what makes it challenging to study those kinds of complicated behaviors in the brain?
Yeah, so I guess from one end, the stimuli is very complex, right? Like there's another mouse, and also quantifying the behavior itself becomes a challenge. When you have two identical animals, then you need much more complex technologies to be able to track the two animals. And for decades, scientists have just been like hand annotating data, right? And actually, finally, I feel like technology is catching up and neuroscientists are able to use deep learning to track multiple animals. And that just kind of happened. I guess one big challenge is quantifying the behavior itself. If you don't quantify the behavior well, how are you going to understand how the neural activity relates to the behavior?
I can imagine if somebody took a video of me going about my day, there are like so many different levels of detail that you could choose to describe that behavior over time. So like what kinds of things are you keeping track of when you're observing these mice?
They're competing for these rewards. So the very salient stimuli in the room is this reward port, which they want the reward. So who's closest to the reward? How close are they to each other? Are they engaged with each other? So are they looking at each other? Are they ignoring each other? How much are they moving? So is that a lot of detail? I'm not sure.
I mean, to me, it sounds like a lot of detail. Do you ever see the mice doing anything especially like weird or cute that you then like go home and gossip about to your friends?
Most of the time, my mice wear these little hats that are wireless, so that way they don't get tangled. But for a specific type of experiment, we don't really have a good wireless solution. So then they have these cables coming from their head and they would easily break the cables. So we kind of like secure the cables. And funnily enough, the cables in their head became kind of like a tool for them to compete with each other. And it was really funny. So what they were doing to try to get the reward is that they were biting the cable of the other animal and grabbing them with it. Like they were like, get out of the way. That was unexpected and really funny to watch. I was like, oh my God, you're using this cable against each other.
That's so funny. I'm just pictured, it's like Mario Party or something.
Like they're like, you think you're going to get this reward? Nuh-uh, I'm going to hold your cable and you can't. Get out of the way. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Like, if you have something that's, like, physically attached to your body and you just get used to it, you're like, well, I have one, you have one.
I can hold you by your cable, yeah. That moment, I was like, wow, mice are so smart, you know? This is a tool. They used it as a tool, so that was cool.
And speaking of mice maybe being smarter than we think they are sometimes, I know that it's, like, a bit of a controversial thing in neuroscience, like whether complex behaviors like this in mice actually tell us things about these same behaviors in humans. I at least like to think that I'm a little different from a mouse. What's your perspective on that? Like, how translatable these findings would be from mice to humans? And like, what do people in your field generally think about that?
It's been a while since I've had a conversation explicitly about this with a colleague in my field. But when I think about it, at least I can tell you that it's the same for the behavior that I'm interested in, which is social dominance and social rank. It's the same brain region that is involved in that in humans and rodents. At least there's some agreement on the anatomy that controls those types of behaviors. Of course, humans are way more complex, but maybe when it comes down to like the very basic ways that our brain, in a way, like social competition is something that has existed for so long, you know, like if we think about our ancestors competing for resources, I think that at a very basic level, if the brain regions are the same, then at least there is some relevance, I would think.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what that brain region or regions is/are?
It's the medial prefrontal cortex. It's part of the prefrontal cortex. And when we think about the prefrontal cortex, we think about executive function, decision making. So it's a brain region that's very important for impulse control and just making decisions. I like thinking about social rank this way. It's a very basic rule of the interaction. The prefrontal cortex is the brain region that keeps track of the rule. And in a social interaction between two mice or two humans of different ranks, like this is the boss, this is the employee, then the rule is that what the boss says goes over what the employee says because they're the boss, right? So in that very crude way, social rank gives the interaction a rule.
Wait, so this like rule tracking brain region is what we think is conserved.
Exactly. It's conserved. Yeah.
You've like already alluded a little bit to the kinds of experiments that you do, but what does a typical day in your lab for you look like? What do you do when you go to work?
Yeah. So I'll tell you pre-COVID. Days are divided with like, is there an experiment happening or not? And when there is an experiment happening, the experiments happen for a couple of months. So like we work with the same group of animals for a couple of months and we collect a lot of data from them. I am really lucky that my project is developed enough and well-funded enough that I actually have a research technician that helps me. And most of the year, I also had a student. So it's three of us. So there might be a team meeting. So I talk to whoever's helping me that day about the plan of the day. I might be doing some data collection myself. The data collection takes the whole day. But if there is not an active experiment happening, then we're probably processing the data that we got. I do electrophysiology, which is essentially you put electrodes in the brain and then you're recording the electrical signals of the neurons. And there's a lot of something called spike sorting. We do hours and hours of spike sorting. So like there is an automated version of this, but still a human has to like take a look and say, this is a neuron. No, this is not a neuron. This is noise. This is a neuron. So then we sit in the computer. We could be sitting in the computer for hours analyzing that. Or I could be like doing a little bit of coding so then I can process and analyze my data, visualize the data, or I could be writing a grant as well. So I guess that's a typical day.
Maybe there is no such thing as a typical day because there are so many different activities to choose from. Everybody's research has been affected by the pandemic. And I'm wondering, like, how, if at all, has your work shifted since we've left the before times and now everybody's lives are all wonky? Like, how has that affected your research personally?
I was lucky enough that, you know, I've been working on this project for almost 3 years, so I have a lot of data. And the pandemic came at a time that I was sort of wrapping up, you know, like doing the last few experiments before the manuscript. So we decided that instead of doing those extra experiments that we were anticipating to need, that we were going to try and maximize the data that we had. So it's made it such that data analysis is more the bread and butter. Like, we are really trying to dig on the data in a way, in a nitty gritty, and explore it to a level that we wouldn't have done it before. Maybe it's been a blessing in disguise.
You mentioned that you had a really influential mentor as an undergrad, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you found that mentor and how that influenced your trajectory as a scientist.
Absolutely. So I'm from Puerto Rico, and nobody in my family has ever left the island for pursuit of an education. So that concept was something that was foreign for me in my life. I was like, oh, other people do that. You know, people that have a lot of money, or other people, or people in movies do that. Like, so I lived in that bubble. I didn't know a scientist. Becoming a scientist was definitely not in the repertoire of the things I could imagine. And so when I started college, I went to the University of Puerto Rico, which is the most affordable option for Puerto Rican. And I knew I was interested in the brain, but I didn't really know what career could be a possibility except studying medicine and then being a neurologist. So that was sort of my plan. And then I met this older student that told me that he did research. He studied fear. And I was like, what? You study fear? That's crazy. He told me, if you want to come see the lab, you can come see the lab. And I didn't even know there were labs in Puerto Rico. So I was like, what? There's research labs? This is crazy. So I went to see the lab, and then that turned into him getting me a meeting with the PI, because I became interested in volunteering immediately. I was like, oh my God, I want to be part of this. How can I be part of this? Turns out, little did I know, this was honestly serendipity and luck, because I didn't know that this was a very prominent neuroscientist, right? I ended up choosing the lab that was the most well-funded lab in the whole island. Across all disciplines, you know, it's one of the few labs with an R01 in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is not a place that has a lot of research funding. Most labs don't have a lot of research funding. So, you know, that's obviously really limiting, because research is extremely costly. Experiments are really expensive, which is really unfortunate. Not everybody gets to do science, which is problematic, I think. But anyway, so I happened to choose a lab that was respected, well-funded, that had a mentor that really cared about being in Puerto Rico, that he had chosen to be in Puerto Rico because he knew that there were more limited resources, and that he believed that his mentoring and what he was offering to the community was more valuable because there's less opportunities, right? If you're in a situation in which this student could receive training in any of 100 labs versus there's very few labs where this student could receive training. So it's more valuable when it's a scarce resource. And so I happened to walk into this lab and join this lab. So it was, I guess, hopefully destiny meant to be, I don't know. I ended up being in that lab for 3 years. The PI was very committed to mentoring. Mentoring was really structured. You know, we had weekly journal clubs that were mandatory. There was no seminar series. That's super expensive. Nowadays, now that we're experiencing watching our colleagues give talks online, this is definitely gonna make it more equitable, because schools that don't have money to fly in speakers for seminars, or that people are not interested to give a talk there, now this is a possibility. But we didn't really have seminar series. So the way that we were gonna learn about what was happening in the field was discussing papers and taking it really seriously. So we had that. We also had science retreats twice a year, and we had individual meetings with the PI plus lab meetings. So it was a lot of meetings, but they were all really important because there was not a lot of other resources. So, you know, all of the scientific training plus the neuroscience learning had to happen in the lab. Yeah, so I'm really grateful for that mentor, that person who took mentoring so seriously and dedicated his life to that, you know, because he could have been in any other institution. So, but he purposely wanted to be in a place where his mentoring was going to really make an impact and a difference in the student's life.
I'm assuming that now you are a mentor to other people, because you've been a postdoc for a while now, right? So has that influenced your mentorship practice at all?
For sure. As an undergrad, I was taken very seriously, both in the my ideas were taken seriously, but also there were high expectations for me. That was empowering to me because it was like, you are a scientist. You could be an undergrad, but you're equally a scientist like these other people that are in the lab. So that was a very striking difference compared to how I saw undergrads get treated in other labs. So I make sure to have high expectations of them, but also to take their learning seriously because they're contributing to the research just as anybody else. It definitely influences how I treat undergrads because I had such a wonderful training experience that I kind of want to give that forward for sure. I try to.
Do you have any advice for undergrads who are maybe seeking a mentorship opportunity like this? Like, how would you find someone like this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really lucky that it was like someone I knew was already in that lab. And sometimes it's much easier if you know someone as opposed to like if you're writing an email. And we all know that sometimes emails get lost. So I would say finding the right lab could take you some time. Don't rush joining the first lab possible. When you're considering joining labs, try to consider more than one lab. And compare the environment, right? Like talk to the grad students. If there are other undergrads, talk to them. Like how is their experience in that lab? And just be a little choosy. Choose the environment you want to be in. Sometimes young people get blinded by like the exact, oh, look at these papers that this lab has produced. I want to be there. It's not about where the papers got published or the exact topic of the research. What will benefit you the most is the type of research environment. And sometimes you can receive very wonderful mentoring regardless of the exact scientific question that's getting answered. Don't get focused on the scientific question, but look for the really good training environment. And how do you know if it's a good training environment? You have to talk to the people there.
I did want to give you some time to talk about your own podcast, because I know that you do the Stories of Women in Neuroscience podcast.
Yeah, sure. So the project, it's a podcast, and also we have a written component. We make profiles for the women that we interview, and then that interview becomes a podcast episode. The story behind it is that I was organizing a seminar series back when our lab was at MIT before we came to the Salk Institute. So at MIT, I was tasked with like pulling together suggested seminar speakers from the trainees of the department, and I was reviewing the names, and essentially we had to like go through them, and it's MIT, so they have to be really famous and really good, and like their research has to be interest. So we were like sorting through the names and Googling them and checking them out and seeing how they talked or what their research was about. We have been like looking at the names for like an hour, and says like, Nancy, we can't use this. And I'm like, what do you mean we can't use this? These are wonderful scientists. And he's like, there's not a single woman in this list. And I'm like, nah, that's not true. And then I looked again, and then I looked again, and then I felt horrible. Number one, because I didn't even realize, you know, that I was blinded to the fact that no single suggested name was of a woman. And then I also felt horrible because I suggested several names and I didn't suggest a woman. And my friend who was also in charge of this didn't suggest a woman. So then we had this little moment of panic of like, who are some of the good women neuroscientists, you know, like the really impactful women neuroscientists. And then we were Googling it and we found a couple of repositories, but they were just like really long lists and they didn't tell you details about their work. And then we went to some of the major conferences programs. I'm like, oh, we got this. We're going to look at the names of the people invited for the Society for Neuroscience. Those are the famous women. And then those women had already come to MIT. And it was crazy. I was like, this is ridiculous. How do we not know the names of women? And it gave me this like feeling of like, there's these really, really famous women in neuroscience and they're really visible, but the rest are invisible. Like nobody knows them. Obviously they exist, but like, why don't we know who they are? And I was frustrated that I didn't know them. So I was like, I'm going to change that, you know? So that's how the project was born.
It's so frustrating because I do feel like if you were to ask anybody who wasn't a scientist, like, can you name five scientists? Like, if they could at all, they would all be like men who are on TV. So I think that just increasing the visibility of being like, there are people who aren't old white men who do science is super important. Do you have a favorite interview that you did through that project or like a favorite takeaway that you have?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this recently because we just celebrated our first year anniversary. So I was like reflecting on like what I've learned. And I've learned a couple of things from interviewing women. One of them is that nobody gets to their neuroscience career in the same way. Like, everybody has a very unique path. There are patterns. There's the people that got interested in undergrad, the people that, like, they were doing something else in grad school and then they switched. So it's kind of cool, like, to see that at every level, it doesn't have to be that in high school you decided you were going to study the brain. People who are neuroscience professors today came to it in their postdoc. It's not a linear path, which is really cool to me. Then the other thing is that nobody does it really alone. Everybody receives help from people, especially like there's very influential mentors that people have at every stage. So I think like knowing that it's not like people are superwomen and that's why they make it. It's like they have support systems and they utilize those support systems. Like you need a support system in order to make it. Nobody does it alone. Nobody has the same linear path. And also everybody at some moment in their career, all the women that I've interviewed have felt insecure. And sometimes it happens really late. One woman I interviewed, like while she was applying for faculty jobs, like she wasn't even sure she wanted to be an assistant professor. You know, it's like crazy. Like she wasn't sure she had what you needed. I think seeing how it's so normal to feel insecure and like to suddenly lack confidence, then you realize it's normal. So then like, oh, okay, everybody's feeling this way, regardless of how successful they are. It's okay if you feel that way. That doesn't mean you need to quit. That doesn't mean like there's something wrong with you. So for whoever is currently like thinks that they're not good enough, a lot of people think that way. Even really successful people think that way. So nothing's wrong with you.
It's both like so reassuring and so sad that it's like you can't really achieve your way out of imposter syndrome. It's like, oh, you thought getting a degree will fix it. It's like, oh, no. Then you're just going to be like, I don't deserve this degree. Everybody's telling me I'm smart, but they're all wrong. I'm secretly dumb. It sounds like it never gets better. But the good news is it doesn't get better for anyone. So it's like we're all insecure together and it's wonderful.
Yeah. So just in a way, ignore that insecurity and keep going. You know, just keep going. Just like, oh, it's going to go away eventually. It comes on waves, like up and down suddenly. So just ignore it. It's normal. It's normal.
Are there other questions roughly in your field that you think that people are especially excited about these days?
Machine learning, it's really hot. It's possible that it's hot across all STEM fields right now. For those neuroscientists that are studying behavior and they're trying to relate like something in the brain with behavior because of computer vision technologies like deep learning being so advanced right now, we are able, like what I was telling you earlier, like that, oh, we can quantify the behavior much better instead of having a person there look at the screen and like write down what the animal is doing. Now we could use deep learning for tracking the behavior and also use unsupervised machine learning to see patterns in the data. And that actually applies to both the behavior and the neural activity. I think that's the hot thing right now.
Yeah, I think I even just looking through BuzzFeed articles and like random things on the internet, I feel like everybody thinks that machine learning is so cool. Oh man, did you see that crazy tweet that Elon Musk posted recently?
Yes.
Elon Musk posted a tweet that basically said he was going to record neurons in real time and...
As if it was a transformative thing. As like, oh, I'll show you because nobody has ever done this. Like,
I know, and I found that so frustrating because it's like obviously like you and a bunch of other neuroscientists have been doing this since 1865 or something. Like it's not new at all. Are there other instances of things like that that you've run across on online or in pop culture where you're just like, man, these people don't understand what I do and I really want to correct them, or like some misunderstanding people have about the brain?
This is not specific to neuroscience at all, but if the general public understood better how science works, there'll be more trust. Part of the reason why some people are so anti-science, I don't know, they don't trust scientific findings or whatnot, is because they're confused about what a fact is. You know, like when people say like, oh, that's a fact, that's being proven. I kind of wish that people understood that it's just evidence-based. There's evidence for that. And the same way you can get evidence for something, you can get evidence against that later on. Like, science is a self-correcting organism. And it's not exactly that things were done wrong the first time. I think maybe there's something like, if people believe that any given paper or any given experiment is like, that's a fact, then they don't understand why it changes. And that's what maybe creates the mistrust. So I wish that people understood that it's all about evidence-based and that evidence changes over time. Therefore, what we think as a fact, quote unquote, changes over time. So I try not to use fact, a fact, because it's a concept that in a way it could be meaningless because there's just evidence for that. And eventually there could be evidence against that. So it's a dynamic process. So I think if people understood that, they would be more realistic about when they read scientists found blah, 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 blah. You know, like, it would be better and more honest. Then it might lead to people trusting more science because they wouldn't feel like betrayed, like, oh, it used to be a fact and now it's not, like, you're lying. It's so confusing, you know. Science is self-correcting, which is great because that means we can catch our errors, right? Like, as technology emerges or as, you know, there's like a new framework and suddenly somebody realizes something or many, many different labs realize something and then we self-correct over time. That's a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
Right. So, like, people should probably just understand that science is messy and we're all confused and we're just trying to do our best.
And we trust that it self-corrects over time, right? Like, as things become more clear, we can do things better. So it's not like it's all pointless because it's confusing. No, like, over time, we can be more correct and better over centuries.
Right, but it's definitely slow.
Yes, very slow and hard.
People can't expect scientists to magically pull solutions out of thin air. That's not how it works. Science is slow and hard. How long have you been a postdoc?
I've been a postdoc for 4 years.
Okay, so I feel like the future of the next step is probably somewhere floating around in your brain.
Yeah.
Do you know what you are planning on doing after this postdoc yet?
Yeah, so I definitely want to have my own lab if possible. If someone would give me a job to have my own lab, I will take it. I just got a K99, which is a transition award. So it's a grant that gives me funding for the little last bit of my postdoc and also gives me funding for the first couple of years of my own lab, assuming I'm able to secure a job. So that's a huge deal because I had to write on this grant what I want to do in the first 3 years of my lab. So I've already done a little bit of that thinking. I want to continue studying the social brain and I want to start understanding how social memory plays a role in social dominance.
Ooh, wait, that's so cool. Can you tell me more about that? So studying how social memory affects social dominance?
There's two potential models. In this way, mice and humans might be different, but mice care a lot about smells, and dominant mice, their pee smells differently. They have specific proteins on their pee that only dominant mice produce.
What? Wait, how does that happen?
I'm not sure about the mechanism, but there is a correlation of changes in hormones. As you become a winner, as you like dominate your cage or your group of your environment, your levels of testosterone and your levels of other proteins are changing. And at the same time, other hormones. And at the same time, this particular protein in your pee starts increasing. So it's a correlation. So maybe the changing hormones might lead to the change in the protein pee, or maybe it's not. I don't know the exact mechanism, but I know they do correlate. But the purpose of it is to signal. So mice are creatures that use smell a lot and they smell their environment. Dogs do it too. So many other animals do it too. They mark the territory, right? Think about how a dog pees everywhere. They're marking the territory. So mice do the same thing. And if the pee smells a certain way, then that's a signal for the other animals. Like, hey, this is my territory and I'm really dominant. I am the boss. Because of this, the pee of a dominant animal is different. You could have a model in which you don't need social memory. They smell different. So that's how you know they're dominant to you. The other potential model is that the smell is actually not that important for the social rank information that you have in the brain. And what is important is the memories of all the experiences you've had with this individual. So those are the two alternative models. And of course, it's possible that both things are playing a role.
As you were talking about that, I was trying to think of how that might translate in like a human situation. I'm like, if your boss or something just shows up to work wearing a really expensive looking suit every day, you could be like, oh, you're the boss because you're wearing that suit. Or you could be like, you're the boss because of all of the interactions that we've had that lead me to believe that you are my boss. That's so interesting.
Yeah, body language too. There's been some psychology experiments in which like people are asked to rank people in the room, and then they're part of an experiment. So they're holding specific body poses, and then there's some specific body poses that people will think that you have more power because of that body pose. So we're visual creatures, right? So we're using the visual information of how the other person is presenting themselves to decide how much power that person has over you.
So when you're thinking of designing these experiments that you would want to do in your own lab in the future, where do those ideas come from? Like, are you drawing from things that people have studied in mice in the past or things that people have studied in humans? And you're like, maybe we can model this human thing in the mice, or just like, I watched someone do this in a movie and thought it was crazy and now I want to model it in the brain. Like, where do those ideas come from?
You know, I've never thought about like, do they come from like human inspiration or do they come from like animal inspiration? I think that I get more ideas when I'm reading papers. The papers can be of work from humans or work in animals. So I get inspiration from the literature. But I think I also get inspiration from like creative moments of like discussing with colleagues, especially when it comes to animals, because they can't really tell us what they're thinking, right? Like you got to get creative when it comes to the behavioral assays to try and get at specific aspects of the behavior. I'm also, besides this social memory thing, I want to get into what we call pro-social behaviors. Nice social behaviors, as opposed to behaviors of competition or dominance. I want an aspect of my lab to relate to understanding how we cooperate, like the neural basis of cooperation and all the positive behaviors, as opposed to the more negative dominance-related behaviors. I think it's really important to study disease and to study more negative things like stress. But I think I'm more, as a scientist, I am more attracted to positive behaviors. So I'm really excited to start doing research on things that are really positive, like cooperation.
Do you think that cooperation and competition fall on opposite ends of the same spectrum where the same brain regions are involved in both?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. So that's why I'm really excited to try and start studying that, because I think that the very same neural circuits could be controlling both of them.
Yeah, I've like never thought of it that way before, but that makes intuitive sense that that's how that would work.
But I have no evidence right now.
I love that. I think I asked you all of the questions that I had pre-thought of. Is there anything that I missed that you want to share?
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for giving me this platform. And I want to emphasize the importance of finding the right training environment, regardless of the type of research, that for people that are interested in pursuing a career in science. Early in your training, it's not about the exact scientific question, it's about the training you're receiving and the mentoring environment.
I hope that at least one undergrad is listening and they'll be like, oh yes, I should do that. Thanks, Nancy. This episode was produced by me, Celia Ford, with help from the team at Carry the One Radio. This episode was supported by the Office of University Development and Alumni Relations at UCSF. An extra big thank you to all of our Patreon supporters, including Colombo Ahmed, David Cabral, Janine Cuevas, Levi Kai, and Stephanie Redmond. If you have a little extra cash floating around due to, you know, the entire world being canceled, please send some of it our way. We would greatly appreciate it. Just head to patreon.com/carrytheone. Your donations make our science communication possible.
And something else that we always appreciate, comments and reviews free of charge. Let us know what you think. And if you need more content to fill your brain, you can find our whole stash of episodes on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and as always, stay healthy, stay sane, and stay curious.